When I was much younger and I was attending college the first time, I was at the University of Redlands at about the time that Richard Nixon was president. President Nixon decided that he was going to come to the University of Redlands and he was going to deliver an address. Now, this is at a time when I was not particularly impressed with Richard Nixon. I thought he was just crooked. I thought he had lied to the American population. And I knew that if I had the opportunity to speak, I was going to set him straight on some things, notwithstanding the fact that I was a college student and didn't really know up from down. I thought I was going to set him straight. I was going to remind him that the power in the United States resides in the people. It does not reside in the president. You can't do whatever you want to do. It's up to the people. We're a democracy, and I was going to stand up for that. I was going to make sure that he understood that. Well, the day came, and he was at the university. He was going to deliver his address, and they were looking for people that could ask questions. And I, of course, submitted my name. I had something I wanted to say to him. And lo and behold, I was chosen. And I was going to have the opportunity to speak to the President of the United States and set him straight. And it came time for me to speak. And it may be hard for you to imagine, but I couldn't think of anything to say. I stood there like a bump on a log. Well, you know, there are other times when the same sort of thing has happened. It wasn't the president, and it wasn't at a college campus. It wasn't me that was supposed to speak, but in the book of Acts, you find an event that is in many ways very similar to what was going on at the University of Redlands. It's a passage that I'm sure we've all read and we've all talked about, how the Apostle Paul is arrested and he is imprisoned at the hands of the Romans. He has to appear before Felix and then Festus, and he appeals to Caesar. And we've talked about that ad nauseum, but we really never think much about what that meant. When the record in Acts 24 talks about the Apostle Paul having to defend himself before Felix. Now, Paul had some things that he needed to say. And the difference between me and Paul was Paul said what needed to be said, and I didn't. Well, let's read Acts 24. And we're going to begin reading in Acts 24 at verse 22. And I've lost my glasses. I can't believe that I did that.
Print's just not big enough anymore. I got the biggest print Bible you can get.
And it's just not big enough. So let's begin in verse 22.
Yeah, let's try this.
Felix, having a rather accurate knowledge of the way, put them off, saying, "When Lysias, the tribune, comes down, I'll decide your case." Then he gave order to the centurion that he, now he's talking about Paul, should be kept in custody, but have some liberty, that none of his friends should be prevented from attending to his needs. And after some days, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was a Jewess. He sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Jesus Christ. He reasoned about righteousness and self-control in the coming judgment. Felix was alarmed. He said, "Go away for the present. When I get an opportunity, I'll summon you." At the same time, he hoped that money would be given him by Paul, so he sent for him often and conversed with him. When 2 years had elapsed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. Desiring to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison. There's a lot in that passage. The first thing that you have to think about in that passage is just who Felix was. You know, I got tongue-tied when I talked to the president. Well, Felix was a pretty important fellow. Marcus Antonius Felix, the fourth procurator of the Roman province of Judea. He was procurator from AD 52 to AD 60. Lest you think that he was just some minor government official. He was just an agent who worked for the IRS in Rome. He was the one who was able to print money. And this is a coin that Felix had minted while he was the procurator. On this side, where you see something that looks like a tree, you see the Greek letters that represent the word Caesar. And you see the date. It was year 3. Interesting. The year 3 means it was the third year of the reign of Felix, who was printing this money. Now, he was important enough that he got to decide that when he printed money, it dated from the beginning of his reign. He wasn't a minor official. And then you see the palm branch. That's what that tree is supposed to represent, is the palm branch. The palm branch generally was a symbol of victory or a symbol of the peace that followed after that victory. And we'll talk about that in just a minute and what that was probably a reference to. On the other side, you get to see here in the picture up here, the Greek letters that mean Nero. So Felix is a pretty important guy. A little bit of background about Felix. He was the freed slave of a very powerful master or mistress, the Empress Antonia. He was originally appointed to be a minor kind of government official in Samaria, probably because of his relationship to the Empress. And then there's a conflict that arises between the Samaritans who were under Felix and the Galileans who were under another minor official named Comnenus. Well, they almost came to blows. It was avoided. Comnenus is recalled back to Rome, and that's the last you ever hear of Comnenus. Is it like the lady that posted the video on Facebook where she said, "I think I'm going to be fired," and she was looking out the door of her office and looking at the HR director coming down the hallway? Well, that's what happened to Comnenus. He went to Rome, he was recalled, had to explain himself, and that's the last you ever hear of him. Anyway, Felix becomes the procurator of all of Judea. So he gets Comnenus's territory. He becomes the procurator. He's appointed by the emperor Claudius, and it's largely through the influence of the man who was high priest, who had gone to Rome and kind of initiated Comnenus being called back to Rome. His name was Jonathan. Now, he is the one who intercedes for Felix apparently in about 52, and he's the one who, or at least has some influence on the one, who gets Felix to be appointed governor or appointed procurator. Now later, Jonathan has a lot to say to Felix about the way that he's governing. Now this is the way that Tacitus says it, that Felix exercised the royal prerogative in a slavish sense, with all manner of cruelties and excesses. It was he who excited the bitter feelings of the Jewish patriots to the highest pitch, and for this, even his patron Jonathan reproached him in the end. How'd he get his job? Well, he's related to Claudius by a former marriage. Felix had three wives, and the one that we're going to talk about this morning is Drusilla. That's his second wife. So he's related to the Emperor Claudius by marriage. Now, remember, he started out as a slave, and we talked about what that meant in Rome. Immediately upon entering his new office, he alienated the affections of the Jewish princess Drusilla, the sister of Agrippa II, from her husband, King Azias of Emesa, sent one of his zealots, Eleazar, in chains to Rome while taking relentless measures against his followers, whom he denounced as robbers, crucifying them in countless numbers. On the other hand, he tolerated the Sicarii, which is the kind of the Jewish brown shirts. That brown shirts is a reference to Nazi Germany. It was the kind of the paramilitary police that he got to control. He used them for his own purpose, as for instance, when he murdered Jonathan, the guy who'd gotten him the job in the first place. He also proceeded rigorously against would-be prophets that were disturbing the peace with their fanaticism, especially against an Egyptian Jew who, with several thousand followers, attempted to drive the Roman garrison from Jerusalem, but he was defeated. That's what Eusebius says. His term of office was practically a reign of anarchy, for even the high priest families were at war with the lower priests. Felix was not a happy camper, but he's a guy who has his thumb on the button. And if Felix doesn't like you, he just kills you. He has that much power. Now, his wife, Drusilla, she's the daughter of Herod Agrippa, who is the king of Judea. She is the sister of Herod Agrippa II. It was her father, Herod Agrippa, who had executed the apostle James. Her great uncle, Herod Antipas, was the one that beheaded John the Baptist. Her great grandfather, Herod the Great, was the one who killed all the babies when Jesus was born. She comes from an illustrious family. She knows how to wield power. Her first marriage, she's betrothed by her father, who died before the marriage happened, by the way, to Gaius Julius Antiochus Epiphanes. And if you know anything about Jewish history, you know something about Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, Antiochus dies before she's married. Interestingly, her father said that she could marry Antiochus Epiphanes, but he had to submit to certain Jewish laws before she could be married to him. Now, her father is not a particularly stellar Jew, but he has this trait that he keeps wanting to impose, Jewish policies. Well, when her brother, Herod Agrippa, became the tetrarch, he broke the betrothal off, wasn't happy she was going to get married to Epiphanes, and he gave her to Gaius Julius Acis, who is the king of Emesa. But again, her brother said, this guy has to be circumcised before he can marry my sister. So there's this weird kind of Jewishness about her. Finally, she's married to Felix. Now, apparently Drusilla was a woman of great beauty. And she was, even though she was married to Asius, she was living at Herod's palace. Felix, one of these minor administrators, goes to the palace for a number of different reasons. He sees Drusilla and he is absolutely smitten. Or at least that's what the historians say. He manages to get her to divorce her husband and to come and be his bride. Well, she does it. He gets her to divorce. Contrary to Jewish law, her husband was not a Jew. She just set him aside. In spite of what her father and her brother might have said, she doesn't really have anything to do with Jewishness. She is a Jewess, but she doesn't care. This creates the ultimate power couple. You've got Felix, who will kill you at the drop of a hat. And then he's married to Drusilla, who doesn't give much concern to anybody other than herself. That's the jury that Paul gets to talk to. Now, Paul has an argument to make to this power couple. And Paul makes the argument. He talks about three different things, or at least that's what the record says. He talked about righteousness. Why do you choose righteousness if you're talking to this power couple? If you're trying to defend the sovereign God, why are you talking about righteousness to this power couple? Because that's what they needed to hear. Romans, the first chapter, the Apostle Paul himself says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. It is the power of God unto salvation. I'm going to reason with these people about righteousness. That's what God expects. And that's what they have to live with. God's expectations. So he reasons with them about righteousness. These are people who are not godly. They are grossly immoral. They are unrighteous, if there ever was a person who was a definition of unrighteous. So that's where Paul goes. Second thing he did, he says he talked to them about self-control. This is not a couple who knows anything about self-control. They live for passion. They are controlled by their lust and their greed. These are not self-controlled people. And then it says, he talked to them about a coming judgment. It's a judgment that comes to all men. Now, some people will welcome a coming judgment, not Felix and Drusilla. If Paul is right, and there is a sovereign God, and he is right, And he really does insist on righteousness and self-control and has promised that he's going to judge those people who don't live the way that they should have been living. Then this is what they needed to know. Felix responds. We don't know anything about what Drusilla thought. We do know something about what Felix thought. He trembled. He was convinced that Paul was right. And he procrastinated. He kept Paul in prison, kept sending for him, kept listening to him. He knew what Paul was saying was right, but he wasn't going to respond. Because he's just so crooked that he's hoping that Paul is going to bribe him. Paul wants to be released. So Paul's going to bribe him. That's why he kept sending for him. He knew it was right. So what do I learn from that? What's that mean to me? Well, the first thing that it means is that when I talk to people about the gospel, I have to understand that even if I could answer every question that they might raise, every objection that they might put forward to the idea that God is a sovereign God, even if I had the perfect answer, some people are still not going to believe it. They're not going to respond. And as Josh McDowell put it in Evidence That Demands a Verdict, the issue is really not just an intellectual issue. It's not just a question of whether it's true or not. It's an emotional issue. If they accept Jesus, they know that they're going to have to change their behavior and their lifestyle. So they're not going to accept Jesus. It has nothing to do with whether or not they think it's true. They're just not going to accept. And then I guess the other lesson that I see for me in this is a lesson about Satan's great deception. There's no hurry. If you're going to respond, do it later. A story is told by Dr. Clarence McCartney about a meeting that he says took place in hell. He writes kind of like C.S. Lewis does in the Screwtape Letters. Anyway, this is the story that he told. Satan called his four leading demons together and he commanded them to think up something that would trap more souls. "I have it," one demon said. "I'll go to the earth and tell people that there's no God." "It'll never work," said Satan. "People can look around them and see that there's a God." Second demon spoke up. "I'll go and tell them there's no heaven." Satan rejected that idea. "Everybody knows there's life after death and they want to go to heaven." Third demon said, "Let's tell them there's no hell." Well, Satan rejected that too. He said, "No, conscience tells them that their sins will be judged," says the devil. "We need a better plan than that." Quietly, the fourth demon spoke up. He said, "I think I've got the solution." He said, "I'll go to earth and tell people there's no hurry." Do you know there's a God? Do you know there's a heaven? Do you know there's a hell? Then there's a hurry. I wish I'd had the courage that Paul had when he faced down this power couple. I wish I'd been able to say what needed to be said. I didn't. Maybe you're in a position where you're facing a power couple. Maybe it's a powerful boss. Maybe it's a powerful friend. Doesn't matter. Think like Paul did. And if you're listening to this from the other side, maybe you're the power couple. Respond. If you know that that's true, then don't wait. We'll help you to respond. We can help you put on Jesus in baptism. All you need to do is accept him. His sacrifice will wash away your sins. You can be baptized, rise to walk in newness of life. And we will rejoice with you. We will help you in any way that we possibly can.